Okay, חברים, ערב טוב. Fifth and last session today about the issue of chosenness and some of the dilemmas that it raises. I built for us a format of a discussion because there are two main goals that I wanted to confront in this presentation. One of them is to first of all articulate the concept of chosenness, and second, more importantly, is to debunk the myth of chosenness and the value judgment that is usually associated with it, and do it, of course, within a Jewish context. And the first thing I'm going to ask as part of the first part of the session is, actually, when we talk about chosenness, are we talking about the conventional mindset, which is God chose us, or in fact we chose God? And both elements here play a significant role, as I will show you in Jewish thought as well. And the second part is, I will try to show that the notion of chosenness is utterly devoid of any intrinsic value judgment, meaning it is not synonymous with better, and that, as a matter of fact, it is actually quite a poor deal between us and God, because we have a lot of responsibilities but absolutely no rights whatsoever, which is another element of debunking the politically correct kind of mumbo jumbo that walks around in discourse around the notion of chosenness. It is not such a good thing to be chosen. That's a great Jewish question. Why me? Why? So let us start. I wanted to start us off with asking you a simple question. How many of you around this table believe in the Mount Sinai event as an event?
Yeah. It's an experience.
It's an event. It's an event that took place.
Historical.
It's an event that took place at a certain point in space and time, according to the biblical narrative. There was a mountain. God revealed itself on top of the mountain to a person whose name happens to be Moses. The ten statements were given, and thus was ushered in one of the most pivotal moments in the shared narrative of the Jewish people.
Irrespective of accepting the Ten Commandments, do you accept one without accepting the other?
No, I just asked now a very simple question. It's not a trick question. How many of us accept this as an event that took place in history? It's not a judgment. It's not a value. I'm just asking. Okay, one, two, three. How many of you here do not believe in this event? Do not believe that the event took place? All right, and how many are obviously, if we do the math, we have a few agnostics?
No, that's why I asked
you to. So, what? Correct me? Oh, that's agnostic, by the way. The literal meaning of agnostic is not knowing. Gnosis is knowledge. So, agnostic is I'm not sure. Yeah, so that's fine. I'm not. It doesn't bear any profound religious undertones. It's just agnostic. Okay, great. Now, how many of you believe in God? Yeah, a concept of God who is communicating with mankind, who is responsible for the biblical narrative and maybe other narratives as well, with whom one can converse, to whom one can pray. I'm not talking about the God of Spinoza. Let's put it this way.
How about the God of Kaplan?
Okay, that's a good start.
The God of who?
Kaplan. Of Mordechai Kaplan. I'm not sure many people here are familiar with the God of Mordechai Kaplan. But let's put it, you know what, I don't know if I can use the word simpler here, but how many of you believe in some sort of a supernatural power who has some sort of an ethical responsibility for the creation of the world and mankind in it? No, not as opposed. As one definition of God. If it wasn't opposed to God, it would be a whole different discussion.
No, because it's two different questions. So.
Well, no, I was trying to be a little bit more specific or simplistic. How many of you believe in a God like that? And I'm not getting into the detail. How many don't? And how many are agnostic? Yeah? We have agnostics? Now let me ask you a different question. How many of you believe that the values, the concepts, the ideas of the Mount Sinai story bear significant relevance to the Jewish people and to us as part of the Jewish people? Okay, that's a less difficult question, I guess. So rule number one to start our discussion is I won't use the term rule of thumb, because I'm not sure you know that, but it's a derogatory term. Rule of thumb comes from a ruling that said that on a Sunday a husband may not hit his wife with a stick longer than a thumb. On other days he can do whatever he wants. So rule of thumb is a derogatory term, so I won't use it, but I will give you a rule. And the rule is that questions of authenticity are utterly distinct from questions of relevance. Did you follow?
Mm-hmm.
Questions of authenticity are utterly distinct from questions of relevance. In other words, the question of whether an event took place or a theological or philosophical precept is acceptable does not necessarily bear, logically, ramifications on the relevance of the values, belief systems, and shared objectives or narratives that arise from that concept. I do not have to accept God as a fact or as a belief in order to say, however, the teachings of that God are something that I hold very dear to my heart. What I'm trying to say now at this juncture, and it's very, very important to start our discussion, is that a lot of people confuse the question of authenticity with the question of relevance. And once they feel ambiguous or suspicious or skeptic or even antagonistic about the authenticity, they throw the entire deal out the window. I mean authentic in a historical context, but for example, God, I'm talking about the authenticity of God even in a historical manner. I mean, if you say, I do not believe in God at all, I don't accept this, that there is something. However, some of the values and the social systems and the ethical backbone of Judaism is something that I hold very close to my heart. And now you ask the question, but said who? Say it is a construction of mankind, and I still hold it very close to my heart. Therefore, I'm going to say the fact that my ancestors wrote that it's important because God said so, I do not accept that as authentic. I do not accept the fact that God said so. However, I do accept the fact that the teaching
is important.
That's what I meant. What I talked about, you're right, is within a historical context, but it's not only within a historical context. The problem we have is once you throw the baby with the water, once you suspect the water is a bit conceptually murky. And that's something that we should put right on the table. In other words, we have to make a distinction between what we call, and now going back to your comment, between what we call history and what we called narrative, or narratives in the plural. The problem being that a lot of people, for various reasons throughout history, will be very happy to furnish you with their narrative in historical guise. Okay? Are we good so far? So once we've established that questions of authenticity are clearly distinct from questions of relevance, once we've established that questions of authenticity are distinct from questions of relevance, now if we deal with the question of chosenness, and now I'm taking it on the most simplistic level, I would claim that the question of chosenness is regarded by most people as a problem in terms of its authenticity. In other words, how can you say that God chose us and blah, blah, blah. And the question of authenticity or accuracy belongs to the realm of the theological relationship between that so-called God and the people of Israel. Whereas the question of relevance belongs to the realm of human discourse and what does it actually mean in day-to-day life to be rendered chosen. Because quite simply, my friends, if you follow the discourse and the problems and the polemics around the idea of chosenness, you'll see that most people are stuck on the level of how dare you call yourself chosen? Who the hell do you think you are that you are better than me, that God chose you and not me? But nobody ever actually takes the further step, needed step, to first of all ask the question, what does it mean? What does it mean to be chosen? Who said the chosen means better? Who said the chosen is actually getting the longer or getting the longer stick in the existential pool game? And third, what are the daily ramifications of chosenness on day-to-day basis? Because my friends, from a historical standpoint, the notion of chosenness has very little to do with theology and has everything to do with day-to-day life on an individual level, communal level, and international global levels. So now we're making two distinctions. One between authenticity or historical authenticity and relevance, and the second between the theological realm of being chosen and the relevant realm of actually putting this into practice as part of a day-to-day life. Now I would like to start us off with a few very, very brief verses that we all know. And you see that I chose, pun intended in this case, I chose the title, The Chosen, The Choosing, and The Choice.
What?
No, not that I'm God. God forbid. What was it with Mel Brooks that he played? Was a part of a discussion with Jesus, and he said something, and he, I don't remember, it was very funny when he said da-da-da, and he wanted to say God forbid, and said me forbid. Something like that.
It's Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks something, yeah. Mel Brooks is a theological source. Okay. Now guys, I want us to look at a few excerpts. The first three. The deal with chosenness, they will not surprise you. I'm sure you all know the context of these verses. And they say the following thing. The first, Ve'aitem li am segula mikol ha'amim, and you shall be a hallowed nation unto me of all nations. The second is even more interesting, Lo mirubchem mikol ha'amim chashak Adonai bachem va'yivchar bachem, ki atem ha'me'at mikol ha'amim ki me'avat Adonai etchem,
The Lord did not set God's love upon you, nor choose you, because you are more in number than any people. For you were the fewer, or the fewest, of all peoples. That's why God, and he continues to say, and because of the covenant that God has constructed with your forefathers. And then from our own prayer on Kiddush, on Shabbat, Shabbat, Kibanu Bacharta, you probably know, Kibanu Bacharta, Votanu Kidashta Mikol Ha'amim, right? For you have chosen us and sanctified us of all nations. Now I want to ask you, what is the context in which you remember in the biblical narrative the chosenness of the people of Israel is expressed? What is the status of this nation, of these people? No, in the biblical narrative. But what is the status of the people themselves on the ground? I'm not talking in vis-a-vis God. I'm talking, who are they? What are they? What is their shared memory? Who are they as a people? I shall have a covenant, right?
Yeah.
But I'm talking about something else. Here, God already talks to a nation, not just to a man or to a family. He talks to a people. And what is the context? What is the situation of the people when he does this redemption, when
they're
he redeems?
They're
enslaved. What else? In Egypt, wandering around the desert. What else? Get into the mindset, guys. I mean, we need to understand text in context. They feel persecuted.
What else is new? What else?
They don't know what's in store for them.
They definitely don't know what's in store for them, albeit one could assume that the narrative, as we know it, was written already in hindsight, in other words, in retrospect. But that's, of course, so there will be people who will argue that vehemently. I want to get to the heart of the matter, guys. This is a people in the desert, like you said, enslaved, surrounded by nations who are far more evolved than them, far greater than them, and they are a minority. This is a narrative of a people who, on the ground, in terms of its political standing, in terms of its demographic standing, in terms of its national security and stability, is at the lowest end of the chain. And one of the things that we find in the ancient world that happens in such situations is theological compensation. If you cannot justify your situation on the ground, you compensate with your situation vis-a-vis God. I am poor, I am screwed, I am persecuted, I am a minority. Not only, but God loves me, because God loves me. And my friends, what I just told you will also become the very core of early Christian mythology and theology, not mythology in the negative sense, theology, the theological arsenal of Christianity. You are now persecuted, you are now chased after, you are now a minority, you are now in pain, you are now suffering. All of your political reality in the world around you, for which you can find no political reason beside to admit I'm poor, but there is a reason for that. No, there is a reason for that. What I want you to understand at this juncture, that when one goes to God to find solace and to put oneself on the top of the theological ladder,
it's an opiate.
Yes, it is an opiate in order to compensate. Now, I'm not saying it opiate in a Marxist sense, because I know you already. I need to be careful with the words you use. So I don't want to fall into a context which I don't aim. But I will use the term compensation on a theological level for a very low ranking in the political realm. This mindset, my friends, will follow the Jewish trajectory until this very day. Again, I said that this notion of understanding the poor, the one who is being sacrificed on the altar, Jesus as being a reborn version of Isaac, the notion of the one who is being sacrificed in order to redeem the many, that's a deeply Jewish mindset. Don't forget that when Jesus lived and acted, he was a Jew, worked from a Jewish mindset with absolutely no vision to reconstruct a new religion. In Jesus' vision, as much as we know it through the early writings, the idea was to reform Judaism. It was not to put Judaism aside and move on to a new. Now we can go into the historical, theological, religious, but that's a different lecture. But I want you to understand at this juncture that the notion of chosenness in many forms has deeply seated psychological roots. And those are to compensate and to create some sort of a rationalism for a reality with which I can barely cope. I cannot explain why I'm so poor, why I'm chased, why I'm persecuted, why I have no land, why I have no home, why everybody is stronger than me, and why everybody is demographically spread further than me.
It gives you a raison d'être, and it gives you the ability to live your life in perpetual agony, and still believe that your reward
for doing this awaits for you in some sort of an eschatological model, which also is abound in Jewish literature and Jewish thought.
I heard someone say, a comedian said in Israel, you know, he talks about this custom of Israeli drivers to honk whenever the light shuts. He says Israel is the only place where the sound of where the speed of sound is faster than the speed of light. The light doesn't change; they already honk. Exactly. To your question, my dear, a fundamental thing to understand throughout Jewish history, where Israel finds itself surrounded by what I will call, I will do it even more visually effective, where Israel finds itself surrounded or in a world where it's a minority, where it is the weakest, where it is the one who needs to abide by the rules of others, for which we will call them Gentile giants.
That's a good one.
That rule over them. When you need now to explain your reality on a horizontal level, on the ground, politically, demographically, and you see that wherever you look, you're on the lower end. You have to find a justification that transcends history and moves on to theology. That's what I call theological compensation. And now what happens? If you look at the evolution of Jewish history, you find that whenever we look at the narrative of the relationship between Israel and God, who is called now the God of Israel, you see that whenever God wants to hit Israel, how does he do it? With the so-called assistance of a certain Gentile giant. Call it Amalek, call it the Assyrians, call it the Romans, call it Khmelnytsky, call it Hitler, call it whatever you want. But then, when you look at the response of Israel, of Jews, to what had happened to them, they don't look at the Gentile giant. They immediately come and say to you, because of our transgressions, we've been exiled from our land. Because of our this has befallen us. Because the covenantal language between Israel and God is so firm in the Jewish narrative, because it cannot explain this. I would now argue that in the three monotheistic systems, this is unique. And why is it unique? Because throughout history, only Jews have been perpetually and consistently a minority. Christianity had no need for this kind of structure, nor did Islam. Wherever they were a majority, or they became a majority. Jews found a completely different mindset, which will inform their evolution up to such a point that it will become a rabbinic decree. It's not from the Torah. To make your life hell until you are allowed to convert. The justification of a minority status is so ingrained into the Jewish psyche now that actually it becomes almost an envisioned desire, an envisioned trajectory to remain a minority. Because this is now far more important than this. Did you follow what I just said? I'm sorry, because of the last sentence. Okay, again. We started from the horizontal level, which puts the Jewish narrative in a very, very dire position. I'm small. I'm poor. Guys, look at Jewish history, for crying out loud. What do we... What? Peddlers, persecuted, poor. Yeah. In the Jewish narrative.
He was proud of that.
No, absolutely. But you have to understand, when you read the stories of Hasidic tales, these were tales, I'm just giving an example, of glorifying the rabbis and doing this and doing that, glorifying Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Rabbi Akiva and all. These people were glorified in the Jewish narrative. The Joe Schmo Roman who lived in the town didn't know Rabbi Akiva from Adam. Didn't care about him either. Because he was a speck on the map of the Roman Empire. The same thing is when you look at the revolts against the Maccabees. That's one of the things that always boggles me. We turned the Maccabean revolt into such a saga
But if we actually look at the broader historical context, the fight there was between the house of the Seleucids and the house of Ptolemy. Two giants, think about two elephants who fight against one another and they step on a house of a mouse. So the mouse now comes out and nibbles at the foot of the of one of the elephants, and then he goes back to his wife and say, I kicked the living shit out of that elephant, let me write a book about it. Now the elephant didn't even know he was there. But from the mouse's point of view, it was a great tale. No, I want you to, I'm not undermining this story, I just want you to understand the difference between history and narrative. We are talking here, when Jewish evolution looks at itself, it finds itself every time in the lower end. It is small, it is depleted, it is poor, it is persecuted, anybody can kick the living shit out of you, only at a whim. Now you need to live with that. Now, you have a question. Do I need to start all over again every time bargaining and doing and knowing quite well that I won't become a majority because I won't? Or do I need to revise? And God, I'm not talking about a bunch of rabbis who sit and say, okay, because this is not rabbinic. I mean, we're talking about something much, much earlier. Do we look at this from a very, very different perspective? And the different perspective is that for our political shortcoming, our political shortcoming is justified, compensated by theological superiority, which now takes the fullest step by saying it's not just justified, it is part of a divine plan. We were chosen by God to be the, first of all, in the days of some of the kingdoms in Israel, in the post-biblical era, for example, Alexander Yanai, who lived in the first century CE, converted the Yadorites of the Golan Heights by force to Judaism under the pangs of death. Okay, also the okay. So we do have exceptions to the rule. What I'm trying to say is that this notion, and this is what I want you to understand, started as a historical fact and evolved into a very elaborated theological construction. It's not just now that I have to deal with it and see how I change my situation, but rather, I was chosen because I'm little, and as part of that divine choice, I will remain little, and more than that, I can find justification, as it were, to the fact that I'm persecuted, agonized, it's all part of a divine plan. You can call it, if you want to use the word denial, one can use the term rationalization, and another can use the term, you know, an evolution of a theological structure. I mean, that happens in other places as well, although on a very different level. I haven't touched the cultural level of this, which I can give you examples from other systems, but first of all, I wanted to show you the notion of chosenness is what I called theological compensation for political strife. That's point number one.
Where does it first appear? Where are these quotes taken from?
All of them from the Torah. Both of these from Shmot, from Exodus. Kibanu Bacharta is from the prayer book. And now, I want us to go to the fourth one, because now it gives us an added layer. Yes?
You know, but this concept that we've been working on since we started, Freud taught us about individual behavior, the very same thing. I mean, people with inferiority complexes compensate, overcompensate, and behave towards others as if they were superior. So, I mean, and that's a common psychological syndrome that's been accepted maybe from before Freud, but certainly today.
Although here happens something else. Here something else happens, because if I took your analogy all the way, I would say the Jews act as if they were superior towards others, and that's not necessarily the case. What you find is Jews living on multiple levels simultaneously because of their historical reality. They speak to Gentiles on one level, do your own thing, I'll do my own thing, I won't interfere, dina de malchuta dina, whatever you rule it, da. Within Jewish circles, guys, there is a reason why we're in this reality. Don't lose sight of the vision. The sight doesn't look well, but the vision is far greater. The value of what we are going through here will be apparent to us in the days to come. This is a corridor. This is a test. All of those words that are being used in Jewish discourse for one main reason: to explain why you are persecuted, what is the raison d'être behind it, and give it some sort of an explanation that transcends history. On a theological level, absolutely, but also on a day-to-day, on a daily life. Because you need to wake up in the morning and still face those hardships and dilemmas.
This is not unique to the Jews, though.
Well, now comes the question of whether it's unique or whether we can find other examples. It wasn't as potent and as clear. What is important for us to remember at this juncture, that when we look at the three so-called monotheistic systems of faith, in that regard, because of its historical evolution, Judaism is unique. Christianity and Islam did not need this kind of a pretext because their historical realities did not require them.
Even early Christianity?
I'll tell you, look, what happens to early Christians was that they saw themselves, many of them saw themselves as an extension of the Jews. No problem there. I'm screwed because I've always been screwed. That's number one. Later Christians, see what happens there. Later Christian, look at the Pentecost. Look at the whole notion of spreading the word, spreading the gospel all over the world. And not only that, in fact, fighting against one of the most fundamental notions of early and rabbinic Judaism, and that is to maintain your distinction. Christianity, its first precept was to include everyone into the gospel, into the word of God, to make, speak in their languages so they can understand you. All of a sudden the language, for example, remember I taught many of you about the Hebrew as the God's vernacular, and I showed you that in Christianity the notion of the language is not as important, because now the language of the message is not as important as the message itself. Whereas in Judaism, the language is part and parcel of the message. And here it's more important that you talk to people in their own tongue, so they join you. In other words, you want to take over the world. Now, taking over the world not in a negative sense, but to spread the word. Now, spreading the word and believing in your ability to do it in a historical contrast is a mindset of a culture that sees itself as a majority. It is not a mindset of a culture who is used to being a minority. Don't forget that what I'm talking about is when it happens already, when after the Ottoman, after the
Constantine
accepted them, the Roman accepted them, they are now part, and there's a whole evolution there where they see themselves now as the religion.
Yeah, that what you're describing may be true of Christians or Christianity as a whole, as a system. But within that system, very clearly, one of the cardinal principles was, as Jesus articulated it, that it would be easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for someone with wealth to enter the gates of heaven. And therefore, God loves not the rich and not the wealthy, and God loves not the people of status, but God loves the poor, the disinherited, the persecuted. So there too, I mean, that's really the prime example of the notion of opium.
Yeah, but I would argue with you on two levels. One, what you now described from Jesus' teaching are an immediate continuum of the Jewish prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and others, who talked about tzedakah. That's number one. Number two, the poor, in that context, are the majority. So I'm talking about something else. The poor is not analogous to the few. The poor is the majority, and God does not favor the ill distribution of wealth where a few gets 95% of the wealth at the expense of the poor, and therefore Jesus says whatever he says. I'm talking about something else, which is seen, by the way, in the image of Jesus himself, the Son of God, who is now being put on the altar as a sacrifice, as a way to redeem the rest of the world. That's a Jewish concept.
Vicarious salvation is a Jewish concept?
It's not vicarious at all. It's not vicarious. The ramifications of what happened with Jesus in later Christianity is a different thing. But the notion of me being chosen and suffering for it in order to redeem others as a principle, as an example, as a choice, because I'm beloved by God.
He was the quintessential Jew.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Jesus was the quintessential Jew.
But it seems that...
You know the joke about him, right? He was 40, a bachelor, and lived with his mother. Do I need to say any... Right? A Jewish mother. Yeah.
And then he believed his mother and they were...
And his mother believed he was God.
No.
That's the last one.
No, his mother was God, and he believed his mother was a virgin.
Oh, and he believed his mother was... Okay, I didn't know that.
What I wanted to ask was...
This is all in jest. I just want to make sure because we're being recorded. In order to see the intimate relationship that people or as systems of faith have with their God. One way to articulate this is the human need, and definitely a human need, to picture God in not only in human form, but in the human form that is part and parcel of your own culture. So for example, if you look at portraits of Jesus throughout the centuries, if you look at a typical version of Jesus starting the 15th, 16th centuries until today, Jesus looked like Brad Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
And to be quite honest, if we want to talk about history, Jesus most likely looked like me. I'm not making any suggestion, but Semite.
Mm-hmm.
He looked like me. He probably looked as a Semitic guy speaking Aramaic, born here, raised here, lived here, of Semitic parents. The readjustment, the reformation of the deity in the context, cultural context of the people who worship that deity is something very, very familiar. So we see in African countries, we see portraits of Jesus as a black person and so on and so forth. The same thing we can see with the ancient Greeks and ancient Romans. Their Olympic gods were part and parcel of the Greco-Roman culture. They spoke in that language. Their customs were in that language. They scribbled in body language. So this is not... The construction of intimacy between the Olympic world, as it were, and the people who worship that world is something you can find in almost every system of faith. But that is on the surface, on the level. Here I'm talking about something far more significant. And that is that the Jews, the Hebrews, and later on the Jewish people, perpetually needed to justify a political reality without... And here I'm going to say something very difficult, without professing theological defeat. Which brings me to the second point, which is very important to understand. Guys, why is God in the Torah? Why is he called the God of Israel? Why isn't he just called God? The God of Israel was the God of Israel. And the God of Israel was going into battle with the God of Dagon, with the thou and the God of that, and he... My father is stronger than yours, so he'll kick your ass. But in order for my God to kick your God needs to be there. The evolution of the God of Israel in the Jewish discourse is also part and parcel of this. You have to understand that it is only much later in Jewish history that we find the God of Israel becoming the God of the universe in the way that we understand it. And again, that was because of theological compensation for a major political problem, namely exile. If the God of Israel is a God that is associated with a certain geography, this is the God that rules over Israel, and now you are kicked out of Israel, what does it mean about your God?
He was defeated.
You cannot bear it. You cannot. How can you say that? Obviously, you cannot say that. So, what do you now say? Blame it.
Blame it on
yourself.
Our own actions.
Blame it on yourself and explain your defeat. It's a premeditated act of your God,
mm-hmm,
vis-a-vis a Gentile giant who did the bid of God in order to teach you a lesson.
Right.
So now, when you are, and again, guys, the same thing happens.
The same rule happens. If you're under the rule of the God of Israel, and here you have another God, 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 and you fall into war with the people of another God, and you lose, and now you find yourself exiled under the canopy of a foreign God, what do you do now? You have two choices. One, admit defeat. And if you admit defeat on a theological level, you might as well absorb yourself into the different system. I lost. Or you come and say, wait. When I said the God of Israel, what I actually meant is the God of the universe. Which now means, look what happens. First, he's still ruling over this area as well. Relax, we're still under his canopy. And second, we are here because he planned it so. Relax, we're good. Theological compensation. We will come back. But at this point, we are not under his sphere of influence. We are not beyond his sphere of influence. We are under his wing.
But why wasn't it possible?
When God, let's talk about it in very simplistic terms. If God now travels here, and this is the domain of another supreme God, what is the status of your God here? Is he a guest? Who rules?
Who rules?
The end of the question is who rules?
But since the God of Israel, before they were exiled, I mean, I don't know what point you're talking about. You're talking about when the temple was destroyed and they were exiled.
I'm talking about the 8th century BCE, 7th century BCE,
Okay, so wait a minute.
Tell me, go on. When did
you?
Where? Tell me what you think. I know where you go. On Mount Sinai, right? Anochi Adonai Elohecha, lo yeh lecha Elohim acharim al panai. Listen to the words. He does not say, there is no other God but me. You shall not have another God but me. Why? Because there are other gods out there. I am the Lord your God. My dear, if I were the only God, I don't need to tell you not to look for others because there aren't any. Wherever you look, that's me. I would say, do not bother looking for me because I'm here. My friends, look at the prophetic literature. All of the prophets, one of the things that bothers them the most is the Israelites still worshipping other gods all the time. All the time. And you need to understand that in the polytheistic system, gods in the polytheistic system were associated with a number of things. Fertility, peace, human emotions, war, right? Natural phenomena. And another one is geography. Certain areas which are under the rule of a certain god. So when the God of Israel says, Anochi, look for example what happens in the narrative of the Exodus from Egypt. When God says to Moses, look what happens. It's very, very interesting. When God says to Moses, go to Pharaoh and tell him, let my people go, ve'yavduni, right? Let the people, so they may worship me, right? Why does, after he hits the Egyptians, and he kicks them, why doesn't he start the ask them to worship him right there and then? No. Ve'yetzu ma'midbar, they have to leave the desert for 3 days. They have to walk for 3 days until they can finally worship God. Why? Guys, you have to understand that the ancient mind, they have to leave the sphere of influence of the other gods. Egypt, the Exodus, is a transition between spheres of influence from the gods of them to my God, the God. V'kasher tavo el ha'aretz asher ar'echa. When I take you to the land which I will show you, the land which my eye is set upon from the beginning of the year till the end of the year, not like the land of Egypt. He said, Lo ke'eretz Mitzrayimi. This is my land. This is where I rule. This is a country that keeps the Shabbat. This is a country where you harvest its fruit, you have to circumcise it. Oh yeah, v'karatta et orlato. Guys, absolutely. Read the Torah. This is a land that obeys the Shabbat. The Ilchot of Shemitah, the rabbinic Ilchot of Shemitah every 7th year. Read Leviticus chapter 25. It says, "Veshavta haaretz shavtoteh." Let the land keep its Sabbath. It's a different mind game. So I just want you to understand this, guys, because again, you cannot enjoy the pretext of looking at this text from the mindset of 21st century rationalists. I want you to understand in its own historical context. This is a land saturated with its God. And if you're kicked out of that land, this is a major existential crisis. You don't just export your God and say, okay, rule over me now. No, it's a crisis. You have one of two choices. You either commit theological suicide and you are absorbed with others, or you take the other way and you do a radical theological compensation. If you kick me out of the sphere of influence of God, I will not lose God. I will turn the entire world into my God's sphere of influence. And this way, no matter where you send me, lechol ma- look what the... What the rabbi say? Lechol makom she'elav galu bnei Israel shechina imahem. The rabbi is now right. To where every place the people of Israel were exiled, shechina followed. Why did she follow? Because she could. There was no other God to kick her out. It's a major, major concept. This notion of theological compensation. And now that we understand this, we do, right? We are on the same page, more or less. Let's take a 10-minute break and continue with the second level of choosing. Yeah.
Is it possible that God needs to have chosenness in order for him to
Second point. Control? Excellent segue in 10 minutes. Why Brit Milah? First of all, just so you know, it was a custom in ancient Egypt. First of all. S was the name
Moses.
Moses was a major, very, very popular Egyptian name. Moshe ki meshitiu minamayim is a later rendition. It's a beautiful rendition, but it's a... Now, guys, in the ancient world, I thought I told you that. In the ancient world, when you went to war, and by the way, it's a custom that is still held in some primitive... You would cut off it and either eat it. You fought your enemy and you overcome them.
That's right.
You would chop off their manhood, either the penis as a whole or and you eat the foreskin as a property of taking that person's manhood and adding it to yourself. Or you would put it on a chain. Okay, so now you are met by a man who has 50 foreskins around the chain. That will be pretty scary because you say, I'm fighting 50 men now, not just one. Now think what happens when such an ancient people now goes to war. When the enemy knows that your foreskin was already taken by their God, how do you conquer a nation like this? Guys, I want you to understand some of the... Because we cannot understand something devoid of context. And the context is not always that romantic. He's already gotten them. There's nothing you can do to me. When God says to the people of Israel, you shall fight and I will be behind you, think about it also what it means when, because they're talking from their own geopolitical, cultural world.
What
wasn't a metaphor. No, Abraham, look, Abraham, Isaac, they are part of the ancient world. These customs existed. All I'm saying is that they are not...
Did it have the same meaning in Egypt? Did it have the same meaning?
It's a good question. Not to that extent. But it had a meaning. I don't know what it was. We have certain... evidence to show that circumcision took place, including not hieroglyphs. Are hieroglyphs, you say? Hieroglyphs that actually show the process. But what is important that you understand is that these things do not come just out of the blue.
It's like the Indians taking scalps.
Yeah. Yeah. In a certain way, yes. Yeah. Guys, the same thing is the pyramids and all of these things. They come from the actual world in which those people live. There is a reason why one of the strikes against the Pharaoh is Choshech. Guys, Ra was the major, major god of the Egyptians. If you strike them, and it's not just Choshech, it's Choshech, darkness, ולישראל היה אור במושבותם, and the people of Israel had light. So wait a second. Where did this light come from? When you have now a theological structure that believes in the sun as the most superior God, and that sun is struck, yet there is light, the immediate question is, wait a second, if that light does not come from him, where does it come from?
Our God.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm talking about? I'm talking about literally a wrestling match between gods. You have to understand this, guys. It's very, very important that we understand context. Okay, now to the question that you asked, and I said it's a wonderful segue. Let's go to the fourth. And here I just gave you the very 2 weeks ago, if I'm not mistaken, was Parashat Truma, right? About 2 weeks ago? Anybody? Yes. 3 weeks ago?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, right? Parashat Truma. Anybody wants to tell us what is Parashat Truma in the Torah? What does it talk about? Okay, building in the Mishkan, right? God comes to Moses and to Aaron and says to them, go to the people of Israel and tell them what?
Donate whatever you would like. Give
uh-huh.
From your heart.
Yes.
ועשו לי מקדש
ושכנתי בתוכם, ושכנתי בתוכם. Guys, the God of Israel, and this is a continuum of what happened in Mount Sinai. In Mount Sinai, we are used to the romantic version that comes and says Moses ascends the mountain, receives the commandments, as it were, comes down, sees the golden calf, breaks it, then gets the 2.0 version, comes back again, and all is nice and dandy, right? But that's not true. Guys, Moses ascended Mount Sinai thrice. Oh, yeah. The name of this class should be Read the Torah. There's a great book, by the way, called that was published. That's another great book. But there's a great book that was written by two Israeli scholars. I forget their name now. But it's called Lo Kach Katuv B'Tanach. This is not what the Tanakh says. And it actually takes most of the stories of the Bible and shows you the popular version as it was taught and the actual thing. And you see unbelievably radical versions. It's unbelievable. It's really unbelievable. I don't know. I saw it in Hebrew. I don't know if it was. I wouldn't be surprised. It's a splendid little book. Lo kach katuv b'Tanach. This is not what the Tanakh says. Now, in the Torah we read that Moses goes to Mount Sinai, speaks to God. God tells Moses, go down and ask the Israelites if they are willing to accept me as their God. Moses goes down again, asks the people, hey, whatever you say to us, Naseh v'nishma, he goes back to God, says, the people of Israel said, yes. God says, no worries, go down, and now in Shloshet Yamim, titkonenu, prepare yourselves, a man should not touch a wife, da 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 da, and in 3 days, come back to me and we shall talk. Moses goes down again, tells whatever he says, and then comes the third time, which is the Mount Sinai event. Okay? And then after that comes Parashat Truma. And in Parashat Truma, God now comes to Moses and Aaron and says, talk to the people of Israel and ask them, each and every one of them, to give Ish Asher Idvenu Libo, anyone will give as one's heart wishes, to build my sanctuary so I may dwell among them forever, or among v'shachanti betocham, among them. Lo v'shachanti b'chem. V'shachanti betocham le'olam. There is another version in the book of Ezekiel that says you. Okay? So, what do we learn from these two examples? What happens here in the relationship between the God of Israel and the people of Israel if the word choosing is now the byword of this discussion? Who chose who? Not just according to God, according to the narrative. Guys, according to the narrative here, it's not just God saying, guys, guess what? I chose you. Because if we want to fully understand the covenantal paradigm in Jewish discourse, if you choose someone and they have nothing to say about it, it's not a real covenant. A covenant requires that there is a two-way discussion and a two-way choosing. And this is something to understand which most people do not even bring to the surface when we're talking about the chosen people. The Jews are also perceived as the choosing people. We were not just chosen, we chose to be chosen. We accepted God voluntarily. No.
It was a mountain over our heads.
That's one version.
But then we decided that he wasn't good enough, so we'll make a golden calf.
Well, actually, I have something interesting to say about the golden calf. Because a lot of people, again, if we understand it in context, a lot of people rebuke the golden calf and say, look, they digressed immediately to idolatry and da da da. Guys, think that you are nomads in a desert. You have no idea where you're going. You left your home. You left everything behind. I'm not sure you would have given your gold and all your money to build something instead of keeping it in your sock or your underwear for a rainy day. No pun intended, given that it's a desert. But the fact is, the fact that the people gave so passionately everything meaningful they had actually suggests that they really needed some sort of an intimate relationship with a deity, which might have been misunderstood here. In other words, it's not just an act of a very simple-minded nation, but rather a call for, we are eager to find this God. And if this means that we have to part of our own jewels. By the way, what happened with the golden calf is exactly what happens in Parashat Truma, just for building a different institution. They're also here, they're giving everything they have. And they do it voluntarily.
But when they built the golden calf, did they think they were building an alternative deity? Or did they think that this would be the way for them to interact with the God that they already accepted?
Wonderful question. One of the rabbis asked this question because it says when they build, and Aaron says, Ele Elohichem, Ele Elohecha Israel. This is your God. Asher Elucha Mimitzrayim, Israel. And of course, most of the rabbis come and say that this comes to mock them. Right? This comes to show them the folly of their... But again, we have to try and at least... Again, this is a narrative. It was written, in my opinion, it was written for a certain purpose. I think that one of the major elements of the golden calf story was to show what form of a theological transformation was taking place with the Israelites after having left Egypt. My friends, you can take the slave, right? You can take the slave out of Egypt. You cannot necessarily take Egypt out of the slave. And what happened under the foot of Mount Sinai was a remnant of the slave who is still there. And by the way, they say it all the time. Let us go back. Give us the meat we need, the water we need. But it takes time to evolve. But again, the action itself is a great act of voluntarism. I'm giving everything I have for this God. It's not just I'm not saying give me something that... And these were slaves. These were poor people. These were people who... You know, to make, of course, lehavdil, elef avdalo, bless you. We heard stories in the Holocaust, lehavdil, of course, no different, but people who had a diamond, who had a golden ring or something, who kept it and just in case something happens. So this is not something to be taken lightly. It was an act there. But what is important for me that you remember, it was a voluntary act. In other words, we need to understand that in Jewish discourse, the choice of Israel, the people of Israel, their choice to accept God was part and parcel of the covenantal paradigm and the idea of chosenness. The people of Israel chose this God, Vayitem li legoy kadosh, and you shall be unto me a holy nation. And by doing so, they went into a covenant with that God, which now meant there is a certain level of exclusivity in their relationship with God. But it also means, if you look at the second version, at the second verse, the Lord did not his love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people, but rather because you were the fewest. In other words, there is almost a prophecy here. The notion of chosenness will always leave you as distinct in numbers. You are already nifdalim, you are distinct from other nations. And now comes the biggest question for us. In what other manners are you distinct? How are you differentiated from all other nations? Because my friends, I want to show you here that the rabbis themselves did not necessarily think all the time that chosenness means better. I want us to look for a second and then we'll go back. But look at when it says Rabbi Akiva used to say. Here's something from Rabbi Akiva. See it at the bottom, the first paragraph at the bottom. Beloved is man, for he was created in God's image. And the fact that God made it known that man was created in His image is indicative of an event of an even greater love, as the verse states, "In the image of God, man was created." Rabbi Akiva here does not mention what? He does not mention the people of Israel. He talks about humanity as a whole, and that the love of God is granted through the act of creation to every given human, by the act of creation itself. And then we find, I'll just finish there, another verse in Avot, in the Mishnah. And look what it says. "Beloved are the people of Israel, for they are called children of God. It is even a greater love that it was made known to them that they are called children of God. As it says, you are the children of the Lord your God. Beloved are the people of Israel, for a precious article, the Torah, was given to them." So what is the distinction between the two? One is a general one that speaks about the God. By the way, in both cases, the God is the God of Israel. It is already the God of the universe, who loves all humans by virtue of being created in God's image. And the other one is now one that is aimed to talk at a much more parochial Jewish level about the unique standing of the people of Israel before God. And in a minute we'll unpack and understand what that means. What that actually means. Okay? Now, you want to say something? Or? Yeah.
In the story of Yitzhak and Simon, isn't there something that when the Red Sea is drowning the Egyptians and the Israelites are cheering?
You're talking about Midrash Rabbah.
God says, "Why are you cheering?
Are
my children too?"
It is a that says that after the Red Sea opened, and the Pharaoh and his then and Moses sang, "As Yashir Moshe et Hashira Azo," the angels praise God and they also echo Shirat Hayam, and God rebukes the angels, not the Israelites. He rebukes the angels. He says, "How dare you sing to me about the death of the Egyptians? Aren't they my children as well?" Well, some of them have, and I'll say we'll even take it further on. And when we get to mystics and Kabbalists, there it becomes really radical. But I want you to understand the evolution of this. That's why I'm not saying it yet. You're right, but not yet. It's not that they hijacked it, because to say that they hijacked it would suggest that it was already in existence and they actually appropriated it. The all-encompassing God had evolved as what I call the theological compensation for a political shortcoming. And I would put it somewhere in the 9th, 8th, 7th century BCE. It's a major concept. I would not get into details here, so I don't want to oversimplify it. But it's definitely part of an evolution of what is known as, way before we get to classical monotheism, which is what every Jew says, "Oh, Judaism is the first monotheistic system." First of all, it's not true. Ancient Egypt, Tutankhaten, was a monotheistic. He was a monotheistic, but in a concrete God, the God of the sun. The abstract monotheism, as we know it, has evolved in Judaism through a number of stages. The first one of them being original monotheism, and that is what I call the God of Israel. And then some sort of a henotheism, which means a God that that acknowledges other gods but rules over them, which is a system that you see in all polytheistic systems. You always see a hierarchy where there is a one Godhead over other gods, right? Like Zeus and Jupiter and all that. And then an abstract monotheism, which will be the ultimate theological compensation, and out comes this God rules over the whole universe. We will also see, and that goes to your question, that the evolution of chosenness will also become gradually more and more radical. And that is that the God of Israel loves the people of Israel more, and therefore we suffer, and we are destined to be the small and live on that level. But even more than that, it will come to a point where it comes and says, actually the whole world was created for the land of Israel, for the Torah of Israel, and for the people of Israel in mind. In other words, that Israel, in all of its versatility, becomes what is known as axis mundi, the axis upon which the whole universe was created. Suffice it to say that such rhetoric was always kept within Jewish close circles, because it was very obvious that if you let it out in the open, in a very, very different political reality, it will be a death. A death.
I don't have something to say about that.
But guys, what I want to do in the next few minutes is actually look at the second part that is distinguished here by a line that says, "Okay, so I'm chosen. What does it actually mean?" Or a politically correct minefield debased. So guys, let me ask you a very, very simple question. What are the responsibilities of the Jews as derived from the notion of chosenness? From the Torah and all the way through rabbinic literature.
To be exemplar.
Through?
Through what?
Tariag mitzvot. We received Tariag mitzvot, 613 mitzvot, aseh, lo taaseh, da-da, there's a whole literature, right? Who is supposed to?
Just us.
Of course, after the destruction of the temple, some of them are replaced because we cannot do the Pulchan in Bet HaMikdash, so we do other Pulchan. And the Goyim, or the non-Jews, have the seven mitzvot, the sons of Noach, right? The Sheva mitzvot, Bnei Noach. Okay. So far, so good. God has chosen us. Okay? And by choosing us, we added upon ourselves, according to my calculation, 606 additional mitzvot. No. The rabbis derived it from the Torah. Okay, we took it upon ourselves, let's say. Okay, yes, we believe God. Okay, now let me ask you a different question. What are the exclusive rights of Jews as derived from their position as chosen? Guys, if I'm chosen and I'm better, I should have some privileges. God should love me more, therefore I should get the better piece of the bread. I should get a better piece of the meat. God should help me get a better house, more money perhaps, a little bit better life. You know, I have more obligations and I have more rights. And if... Shivyon Banetel? You're talking to me about Shivyon Banetel? 606 versus 7. Let's see. I'm doing 606. Give me less tax, less persecution, give me some more power. Okay, I'm small, I accept that already. I accept it to be small. But you know what? I prefer to be a minority that has the money, that has the wealth, that has the power. Why? Because God chose me. What?
In your dreams.
Good, well said. So guys, let's first of all deflate the myth. Chosenness means primarily way more responsibilities and nothing in terms of privileges or exclusive rights vis-a-vis my relationship with God. Well, you know, it's interesting what you're saying, because one of the major arguments that people who believe in the event of the divine origin of the Torah is precisely because of what you said. Will be awkward what I just said, right? And they will come and say, if you look at the cultural context of ancient societies and look at the Torah, it's completely out of context. Why would people even think in such a way? How would they have such a vision? And then people will come and say, if you actually look at the ancient world, you cannot explain how a group of people would sit there, right, and write about such noble things as Shiluach HaKen, as if you take the eggs of a bird, send the mother away, and about not sacrificing your firstborn child to the Molech, and not performing bestiality or incest or all of, because these were common practice. And by the way, the fact that they are saying to you not to do them shows you that it was common practice. So this is exactly one. And by the way, the same thing goes, for example, for Islam, that comes and says Muhammad was a jahil. A jahil in Arabic means uneducated man. And if you look at his Arabic prose, the man was illiterate, could not write or read. And when you look at the prose of the Quran, the Arabic, it's so profoundly intricate and beautiful that they come and said it couldn't have come from his mouth. It had to be some sort of ecstatic speech or automatic writing. Precisely. Okay? So, whether I agree with you or not is a different question. What I'm saying is what you say the question of context here remains very, very interesting. There are many people who will come and say, no, okay, part of the research is to contextualize this. I'm not saying it's not possible. I think it's definitely possible. But even if you, again, when that's why I began my discussion with the question of authenticity versus relevance. Even if you were able, which you won't ever, able to prove, if you found a hieroglyph that says, me, Moses, son of Amram, sat here in cave number 7 and wrote the following things, you would still not be able to prove that this was not divinely ordained. In other words, it's a mute cause. It's irrelevant anymore. That's not the question. The question for us, what I'm trying to do here, is to first of all unpack the issue of chosenness and try and show it in different types of context. And then to take the issue of chosenness and show you that it's not as romantic as people seem to think. Having said that, however, I'll just finish the sentence. Within this mindset of I am small, I am chosen, I am destined to suffer. Does that sound Jewish? There is a reason why it sounds Jewish, my friends. I'm destined to suffer. Never mind, God will provide. Never mind, I'll sit alone in the dark and die on my own. No, guys, that I'm making fun of it.
No,
but these are things that are deeply steeped in our own imagination of Jewish psyche. The mindset of suffering not only became a rationalization of chosenness, but in radical circles among rabbinic and mystical Jewish mindset, it became actually a noble cause to achieve. In other words, the sanctification of suffering. The sanctification of suffering. Asceticism. Asceticism. I'm supposed to suffer. I'm supposed to break my body. Burn me if you want, and I will add fuel to the fire. Well, guys, in my first lecture to you 3 years ago, I said, anybody who starts a sentence with Judaism says is either misleading us or is trying to sell something. Judaism doesn't say anything. Jews do in certain contexts, in different forms, about different issues. So Judaism is not against asceticism. Many rabbinical Jews are, and others are not. And if you look, for example, at the Messianic era, you will see that asceticism is being hallowed and sanctified because you need to actually break the body in order to allow the spirit to come out. And you need to break yourself in order to prove yourself worthy of God's choice. In other words, now we come to a point where people come and say the fact that we are few, and that actually means we are the diamond in the rough. We are better. And at this juncture, it becomes problematic. Because here comes the discourse that now comes and says, God has chosen us because there is something intrinsically existential about the Jewish soul that is set apart from any other soul. God has chosen us because it was a premeditated act in God's mind before the creation of the world. You need to understand, in that mindset, the whole universe was created for the Jew. And God created us because we are the only people who are able to deliver the theological charge, the ethical backbone of Judaism as given in the Torah, to its fullest realization. In other words, we are the only ones who are able to lead all the nations towards redemption. Light onto the nations. The problem, my friends, is that in order for light to be effective to begin with, one must have darkness around it. That's point number one. Otherwise, it means absolutely nothing. When you have light within light, you cannot distinguish between them. And second, when you're talking about light within darkness, it does not necessarily mean that the darkness is less valuable than the light itself. Exactly. In other words, now we're not talking about a hierarchical form of light showing the way to the dark, but rather a symbiotic form where light and darkness take part in becoming something better together. Because unless the dark partakes in the act of the light has failed. So you don't need to prove to me your value. You actually must present your value by becoming involved in the property called darkness. Guys, it is our mindset that sees darkness as bad. But I want to remind you that it doesn't have a value unto itself. The whole notion, in fact, if we want to look at the Genesis story, the existential standpoint of the universe was Choshech. When God says, let there be light, it is a statement that already accepts a certain reality and doesn't deem it bad. It's not that it's bad. When God says, Vayar Elohim et ha'or ki tov, it doesn't mean that the choshech is ra. He never said that the darkness is bad.
Well, what else could it possibly mean if it says that the light is good?
Why? Wait. If I say to you that I have a great love for you, because, and I'm not saying it cynically, that I have a great love for you because you're Jewish and we have much in common. Did I say any word about not loving anyone who's not Jewish? Did I make any negative statement about someone else?
No, but I think that you can extrapolate from that someone who is not Jewish, you would have less love for.
Why less and not different? Look, I'll give you an example. It so happens that my wife is sitting here. Okay? I love her more than I love all of you combined. I don't feel obligated to justify myself. I don't need to explain myself. It seems to me that anyone who is healthy in their soul understands it. You're not offended by it. I hope also that you didn't hear me say that I love you less. But rather, in my opinion, I love you in a very different way. Which means that with her, I have a number of associations which I don't see relevance to do with you. But with you, I have other relationships that I associate myself with. What I'm trying to say here, that the notion of chosenness in that context is first of all a self-assumed property. You don't hear the Gentiles, although there are some, who say God has chosen you. Although there are some who say God has chosen you. God has chosen you. Yeah? Okay. It's a self-assumed proposition. However, guys, it is a self-assumed proposition, according to this narrative, that ultimately has no benefits whatsoever within historical context. It doesn't have any immediate benefit today. Your chosenness does not give you any privileges.
What was the guy who wrote Torat
HaMelech
thinking?
First of all, the guy who wrote Torat HaMelech, I never read Torat HaMelech, so I don't want to judge anything. I heard about Torat HaMelech from the media. And that immediately renders me a skeptic. Because I'm not sure that anyone who talked about it in the radio read it either. Nor am I sure that they understand its context. However, having said that, I would not be surprised if Torat HaMelech and other manuscripts talk about Gentiles in unbelievably derogatory terms, because such literature exists. That does not mean that that is the general Jewish view, or that that is the main rabbinic view or rabbinic historical views about the notion of chosenness. In every element that has a form of exclusivity, you will find it taken to the extreme, and it will border fascism. And that exists also within Jewish people. But that does not mean that that is the intended notion of chosenness.
There's something problematic.
We are in a cyclical mode that has been in existence for over 2,000 years. I'll tell you why. Exactly. The more convinced you are in that notion of chosenness, the greater the chances that you will raise certain anti-Semitic voices. And the greater the anti-Semitic voices, the further entrenched you will be in the raison d'etre of being there, because you understand it as a theological structure. In other words, I'm not surprised that you hate me, because guess what? That's part of my contract with God. So I'm not even looking at you. It's not a fault. It is part of a greater system that reminds you of your distinctness. Guys, you have to understand.
That can be dangerous.
Yeah, but I'll tell you more than that. We also see in Jewish historical context, and guys, that also needs to be debated, and maybe in a different set of lectures, that the inability of a Jew to see him or herself as distinct and even persecuted has caused greater dangers in certain cases to Judaism than anti-Semitism. In other words, assimilation, well, yeah, but again, when I'm talking about a historical context, and I see masses of Jews who try to say, I'm sick and tired of being that distinct, I don't want to see myself as chosen, I don't want to see myself as slight unto the nations, I want to be like anybody else. Two things that happened. One, like you said, although they try to relinquish themselves of their Jewish heritage, the surrounding will not allow them to forget their Jewish heritage. And two, once they were befriended by their surroundings, okay? In other words, the non-philo-Semitism is equally a great danger to the sustenance of Judaism as anti-Semitism. In other words, once you accept the Jew, it may be a death blow to the Jew, because part of the major core of Jewish identity is distinction.
That's
what people say. We are being loved to death.
Bidiyuk.
We
are being loved to death.
One can feel.
And what I'm trying to suggest is that the reason for that historically is that the Jewish mindset is far more equipped to deal with persecution than to deal with acceptance. Its theological construction is equipped with that. That's what I'm trying to show you. It's not just a matter of what I'm trying to say is precisely that. Because deeply seated within Judaism is the fact that you are not even supposed to be accepted.
Look at the suspicion.
That's what I was trying to show you here. I'm not. Again, you're not supposed to be accepted. And then what happens is, you see, from a historical... When you are accepted, what happens? Two major things. One, people assimilate in masses.
No.
Not just that they become ultra-Orthodox. Right. They go further away from that, because that is a far greater threat to Judaism.
Yep.
Then, my dear, look what happened. Look what happened with the woman who built this institution. When she gave her lecture at the parliament, she was called a greater existential threat to Judaism than the Gentiles and the secular.
That's right.
Why? Because she's now pretending to be Jewish and to know the texts, and to interpret them, and she's a, how do they call her, ochelet chazirim, she eats nevelot and then corpses and nevelot, whatever you call them. So they're rabbits or whatever.
It was an amazing.
Now guys, I want you to understand the mindset behind it, because the biggest question that I wanted to set for us here, just to ponder about, is still before us. We have to understand that if you construct a theological structure based on a political reality that now sanctifies distinctiveness as a measure of survival, when somebody now comes to you and says, look, I'm not threatening you anymore, it is a far greater existential threat for you, not because of him, because of you. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to tell you here, my friends, is that Jews don't know what to do with a friendly society around them. They don't know, because it's not part of their... This is one of the things we're trying to deal with now in the modern era for 250 years. If you try to face 250 years with 4,000 years, we still have a long way to go to relax and understand, wait a second, maybe we need to re-articulate that notion of chosenness and maybe even get rid of it altogether. Because I believe that in a historical context, the Jewish mindset is set to defend itself in face of persecution, and once primarily, that's what I was trying to show today.
Look, what happened, I want to explain here, and again, I wish we had another hour, because you're opening great questions here. We have to understand, in a historical perspective, the modern era where Enlightenment started was the first era in Western history where the offer to Jews to relinquish their Jewish identity was perceived only from a religious mindset, and there were other alternatives offered that did not that did not require them to convert to another religion. In other words, you can become a citizen of the world, and we are the enlightened ones are also. We don't want anything to do with Christianity, and we offer you to join. So, for the Jewish mindset, it was not a threat that says, okay, they like the Inquisition. I'm either a Jew or a Christian. If I'm not, I die. All of a sudden, there was a call that allowed them two things. One, to not feel persecuted anymore. And second, not to betray their heritage. In other words, there was a third option allowed to us. To go to the open world and be accepted as citizens. Now, those who were baptized because for their own reasons, I believe. In other words, for their own reasons, practical reasons. There was no theological...
There was no place. I mean, they assimilated. There was no... I don't know that there was a place for being accepted by the surrounding totally without being baptized. I'm just talking... I just want an explanation between the benevolent and the hostile.
I wouldn't call it. First of all, I wouldn't use the word benevolent. I would use the word tolerant. Because benevolent is a far, far greater. I would say the following thing. I think that again, and I agree with one thing that you said, that you weaved into your sentence. Most of the societies who offered Jews some sort of acceptance on a social, political, legal level expected them to become more citizens of the world at the expense of this kind of religious distinction, and at the same time never completely abolished the perception of the Jew as distinct. In other words, you could not... A Jew was a Jew was a Jew was a Jew, and by the way, one of the most potent places to see it in space and time was 1944 Hungary. Hungarian Jewry was deeply assimilated. And when the Nazis finally arrived there and filled Auschwitz with trolleys to Auschwitz from Hungary, Elie Wiesel being one of them, for example, many of those Jews said, but I haven't been practicing. Even my parents and great-parents are no longer... How come you are... So the Jew was perpetually reminded of their distinction, even if they, on an individual level, decided that they want to partake from it. What I was trying to say here, and with your permission, then I'll take it to the final question, is that the notion of distinction is so deeply seated within the Jewish mindset that any kind of social structure that tries to balance the Jew with the Gentile is met with a profound problem by the Jew, because in a historical context they don't know how to relate to it. This distinction is so much part of who we are. And now, with your permission, guys, I want to give the last question. I told you all the time that this mindset of chosenness and the ethical backbone that is derived from it as part of the Torah and light unto the nations, blah, 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 is majorly and primarily governed by a perception of the Jew as the minority in the land of Gentile giants. And now comes the greatest question for the modern era. How do we take this? How do we take this model, which we talked about for 2 hours, and now implement it in a new conceptual framework for the Jew, when for the first time in his perceived history, he is the giant and he rules over minorities? Mm-hmm. In other words, how do we take this historical reality in which I am no longer the minority, in which I'm no longer, but rather I am now a majority, I now rule, I now have the power, I now have the law, I now have the institutions, I now have the say, I now have the missiles, I can kick the living hell out of anyone I want in my vicinity.
and still be chosen, distinct, and work within the mind frame that was built on thousands of years of a different model.
Schizophrenic.
Now, guys, wait, before...
Schizophrenic.
So, guys, what we see... What we see is a very, very difficult evolution of a situation where Israel is in a constant argument.
Right. In a dialogue.
Between argument, dialogue, conversation, between its global... Between its global positioning, mm-hmm. which perpetuates this model,
yes.
delegitimization, we are alone, we are surrounded by enemies, nobody will take yes. care of us if we don't take care of things, da da da, delegitimization, da 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 da, and its social, political, immediate surrounding, its landscape where it governs, and it needs now to find different justifications to vindicate itself and its own.
But it still feels that it's got. But Israel's the mindset is that we're still going to be destroyed, not necessarily by them out there, but by the people who are in a, right.
When I say this, I mean also the Arab world around you.
We have to feel secure. We're going to be destroyed by. So
we have to feel secure. It takes time and it takes time.
And I hope you understand. I'm not taking sides here. What I'm trying to show you here.
You should take sides.
No. But the problem here is that people that they think of us. As
my dear, what did I tell? What did I just tell you?
It's again the changes that are happening.
I won't even get into the American mindset, which was of the most isolated mindset in the global setting. That it's me and the rest of the world if they don't understand me, right? The Americans are the only ones who will travel to Spain and be actually angry at the Spanish for not speaking English.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to show you here is the deep chasm that exists in the Jewish mindset and Israeli mindset is part of that, because we are now at the point, and I will illustrate it here, where the creature that is called the Israeli is and Israel is facing something that is profoundly problematic. The if I had to render Israel in an image, I would actually say it has a small head and a big head. The small head, looking at its relationship with the rest of the world in a much greater historical context, and the big, the sovereign, the tough, the strong, is maybe 65 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to negotiate this with this, where the most immediate concerns come from this region, not from here. Mm-hmm. And what happens now, we are in deep state of schizophrenia, in that sense. And I'm not even talking about the need, we need to talk in different languages to the rest of the world because we render ourselves a Western country, and where we need to talk in a different language to our own immediate world, which is, guess what, the Middle East. In other words, there are a lot of levels here where chosenness is now becoming a major problem. And by the way, what I just told you here is part and parcel in very different languages, much more articulate than me, by Isaiah Leibovitz. When Isaiah Leibovitz talks about the major problem of Israel as someone who occupies, in his language, occupies another person, his major claim is the ethical damage that he does to the backbone of the Jewish people as a people. Which raises a fundamental question, guys, and with that I want to end. And it's quite apt, actually.
He also accused the racists of black people when he says that.
Well, when he said Judo-Nazis and some of his claims that nobody endorses, huh?
No, I'm saying when he says that the reason I'm against the occupation because it hurts us, cosmopolitan intellectuals around the world, that's also racist.
Oh yeah. Guys, the most fundamental question for us to ask ourselves as citizens of Israel, as Jews, as people who live here, is what needs to be done for Israel to become accustomed to a fact that it is no longer a weak minority that is dependent on the mercy of Gentile giants, to a certain extent, because we still, as Obama reminds us, we still are, to a certain degree, with all due respect, mm-hmm. we don't have to compare our situation today to a situation 66 years ago.
Right.
Okay? That's number one. But for us, a question as a nation, as a people, is how do we negotiate this, I don't even know what words to use, this kind of psyche, this kind of memory that is so part of our DNA, and now allow this to become assimilated into a different view of ourselves in light of the fact that our very situation has dramatically changed. And our chosenness now comes with a great responsibility to others who depend on us, whereas for 4,000 years, it was about us, but we were dependent on others.
We became a JG.
We became a JG. A Jewish John. And by the way, one of the reasons that Israel faces such difficulties to stand in front of its own Jews in the diaspora, I believe, is precisely that. Because Jews in the diaspora are still deeply steeped in this mindset.
Right.
Maybe it's dangerous for us to give up that mindset. Because you said...
My dear, relax. It won't happen. It won't happen. It will never happen. No, I'm not kidding. It will never happen, not because I don't want it. It will never happen because the world will not allow it to vanish. It will not happen. However, I do say that there is a much greater level of healing that we need to create for ourselves in order to come to terms with the fact that we are no longer poor and small and persecuted on that level, and yet maintain an ethical kind of a backbone that requires a much, much different approach to our relationship to others in this world.
I heard something from an Arab intellectual that puts another angle on it.
Is that an oxymoron or is that...
No, God forbid. God forbid. Yeah.
He said, the Israelis, the Jewish, in Israel, the Jewish relation with the Muslim minority is that the Jews are majority and still think like a minority, and the Muslims are a minority and still think they're a majority.
Beautifully put.
And this is the first time in Muslim history that in the Middle East, a major Muslim community
Which is a major problem. Absolutely.
We can't get used to being a majority.
Very, very well put.
That's
very well put. I talked about the Jewish part, but I think that... Yeah. Guys, it was an honor and a pleasure. And, let's say...